IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast supported by Pragati, a flagship media initiative of the Takshashila Institution. We're a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like to bring a fresh perspective to Indian affairs and an Indian perspective to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to yet another episode of All Things Polity. I'm Amit Kumar, a research analyst with the Takshashila Institution's Indo-Pacific Studies Program. And today I have with me my colleague Anushka Saxena, also a research analyst with the Indo-Pacific Studies Program. And today we're going to be talking about the two sessions developed, the developments that went during the two sessions, and what are the key highlights of the two sessions. So to give you, our listeners, very quick overview of the two sessions, it refers to the congregation of China's two topmost deliberative bodies of the CPC that meets once in 5 years. And this meeting, the 14th NPC session, was the first inaugural session after the 20th Party Congress. The two bodies in question here are, of course, the National People's Congress and its advisory body called the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, also called as CPPCC. So this newly constituted Congress is the 14th NPC, and the strength somewhere ranges around to 3,000. And the membership of the NPC consists of members indirectly elected by respective provincial legislatures, in addition to representation from 8 other key political parties, the PLA, private enterprises, and of course the religious groups. So I would like to ask Anushka, what do you think were the key development that you think that our listeners should know from these two sessions?
Right. Firstly, thanks, Amit, for having me here. I think the two sessions had a lot of deliberations that took place, a lot of interesting appointments that may have repercussions for various fields ranging from politics and geopolitics to science, technology, and the private economy. And I think the one kind of aspect that the two sessions reaffirmed was Xi Jinping's power and authority within the country by reappointing him in a rare third term as president of the country. And other appointments of interest include Li Chang as the premier, Qin Gang as the state councillor, and Li Shangfu as the minister of defense. We also witnessed expansive institutional reforms under the state council institutional reform plan, and then under the more recently introduced, I think it came out on 16th March, party and state institutional reform plan, which is much broader and refers primarily to the reforms that have taken place under and across bodies in the mandate of the central committee. There were also sweeping financial reforms ranging from the institution of the central financial committee to other reforms pertaining to regulatory bodies, the establishment and reinvigoration of a social works department, that a national data bureau, and more recently under the party and state institutional reforms, that of a work office on Hong Kong and Macau. And I think these reforms, even though they centered in and about the state council, have kind of reaffirmed the fact that the party and state are now deeply intermingled, and the distinction, we're moving away from that distinction, with more power resting in the central committee and its core, which is...
Yeah, we'll come to the party-state distinction first. But I want to first ask you about the list of appointments. So Li Chang was appointed as the endorsed, his position as the premier was endorsed during the two sessions, although it wasn't a surprise. But, and he also, of course, held a press conference and struck a very reconciliatory note with the private enterprises on the questions that were asked to him. So what do you make of his appointment? What do you think maybe going forward, what anything are things like? There has been a lot of optimism. And do you think things are likely to change with regards to economy and private economy?
Right. So, as you rightly pointed out, Li Chang's appointment was pretty much anticipated. And Li Chang has traditionally been known as someone who's very business friendly, even as he was resolutely implementing the zero COVID policy in Shanghai. He was known to have brought in a lot of foreign investment in Shanghai during that period. So yes, he's known to have struck that delicate balance between being business friendly, promoting the growth of the private sector, and at the same time following the Xi Jinping and the party, the mandate of the party by word. And this was especially witnessed during the imposition of the harsh lockdowns. And this is all played out in Shanghai, which was his last appointment before being promoted as premier. And you mentioned this press conference, and he lays down a very elaborate agenda for the state council and the party to follow. Even though some of these priorities have been reiterated in the past, some of the important ones include following by word the comprehensive and strategic plan for the country's development that was laid down at the end of the 20th Party Congress in October 2022. On economic policies, he talks about redoubled efforts to, you know, kind of mitigate the kind of economic headwinds the country is facing. He was open and admitting about the fact that, you know, both the domestic and the global economies facing several challenges. They're driven by uncertainty, instability, and unpredictability. So there is a clear acknowledgement that there is a liquidity crisis. But at the same time, he also reminds one and all that this is not unique to China, and it's happening in countries across the world. And so he does kind of reaffirm that optimism on his towards his business friendliness, where he argues that that there will be more openness and transparency for the private sector, and the private enterprises will enjoy a better environment and broader space for development. And then, of course, he also talks about Hong Kong and Macau, and he says that there were some difficulties in their economic development as well due to various factors, without elaborating on what those were. And so, regardless of those, he kind of reiterates that the central government will still fully and faithfully implement the one country, two systems. Right.
Yeah, so his appointment and the press conference has given rise to a lot of optimism, certainly. But I have a few reservations of my own. I mean, of course, there has been talks that given that Li Chang is a Xi loyalist and that he'll exercise more and more autonomy in economic decision making, and the fact that he has been pro-business throughout his previous stints, we are likely to see some easing on the private economy front. And as you mentioned, he in this press conference also reiterated the two unswervings, which essentially means that the private enterprises will be given priority or will be encouraged and supported at par with the state enterprises. But then again, this reiteration has been supplemented with the three unchanged, which essentially says that the party's policies with regard to the private enterprises has remained rather unchanged. And this makes me a little skeptical, because if you look at the party's record in the past few years, it has been mostly that of tightening of the regulations and crackdown. And also, we haven't seen Li Chang return as the chairman of the party leading small group on economy and finance, which has, you know, traditionally been led by the Chinese premier until Xi Jinping placed it under his chairmanship of the general secretary. So I think, this gives me a sense that although the party is has said that the private enterprises will be supported, but I think it will be only so long they throw the party line. What do you think?
I think I do agree with that assessment, in that I think the reiteration of the two swervings stands out for me here, because the two swervings only about encouraging and supporting the private economy, but also guiding them. And as you rightly mentioned, how the policy on guiding the private sector has played out in the last few years is that there is an intense tightening of regulatory control over how two of the key sectors of the Chinese private economy function, which is the real estate and the platform economy. And this tightening of regulation is likely to not go anywhere, especially considering that there has also been a lot of optimism generated in the past few months because of the slight shift in tone of economic policy. So because there is greater focus on infusion of liquidity and fiscal stimulation in the country, which is largely a pragmatic move to consolidate and accommodate repercussions of the zero COVID policy, the pragmatism is also likely to play out in whether or not in the private sector economy and enterprises are still towing the party line, and there will only be so much fiscal stimulation as is necessary to not allow the disorderly expansion of any of these capital enterprises. And so, yes, it's good to be optimistic about all the promises Lee Chang has made in his press conference or any of the other economic policies have made in the past few months. It is still to be noted that the guiding and adhering to the party line isn't going anywhere.
Right. And as you mentioned before, that the party and state distinction has almost disappeared. And we have seen the state council has witnessed a consistent erosion of its authority under Xi Jinping. And so it remains to be seen what sort of autonomy does Li Zhang actually enjoy. Okay, we are coming on quickly to two other appointments, which I think are of importance. Qinglang's endorsement as the foreign minister and his elevation as the state councillor, and Li Xiaofu's appointment as the defense minister. So to me, these two appointments appear to give some misgivings. On one hand, Qinglang's appointment was seen as China's attempt to, you know, stay away from backtrack from its what's known as China's word for it is, but Li Xiaofu's appointment seems rather like an assertion. What do you make of these two appointments?
Right. So I think we discussed this before as well, that Qinglang's appointment kind of signals that shift in diplomatic approach. It indicates a softening of China's image as a wolf warrior. And it's important because Qinglang has extensive experience negotiating with the United States. And so that kind of promotion to state council, that rapid promotion from ambassador to foreign minister and from foreign minister to state councillor is indeed kind of an indication to the United States that China still follows the policy of negotiation before aggression, although that might not likely be how it substantively plays out. This, signature or this kind of indicative appointment is necessary to dial down on some of the tensions and the heat between the two countries. Now, China also has its own internal priorities to take care of. And what I make of Li Xiaofu's appointment in that regard is that it might have less to do with China's diplomatic outreach to the US and more to do with the kind of value he has for the modernization of the military and the People's Liberation Army. So the general that Li Xiaofu has replaced as a defense minister is Wei Fenghe. And both Wei Fenghe and Li Xiaofu have been staunchly dedicated to the cause of modernization of the military forces of the country. Li Xiaofu himself is an aerospace engineer, and his appointment only affirms the trend that is taking place under Xi Jinping, which is that of appointment of those who are skilled in these technical fields for, you know, achieving the goals of mechanization, informatization and intelligentization that the military forces are holding so dear. And it's something that they have to achieve on a very short deadline, that is by the centenary of the PLA in 2027. Yes, indeed, Li Xiaofu is a sanctioned person in the United States. I think he and the equipment department of the CMC were sanctioned in 2018 because they bought Sukhoi fighters from Russia. However, that has only come up because of his appointment now, and it doesn't really have a bearing on the kind of value he holds for his military advice or his focus and emphasis on modernization. I think domestic goals, those goals of military modernization, are more important. And I don't think they've read that much into it, that, you know, it may also have repercussions for their diplomatic outreach to the US, although what actually happens on ground remains to be seen.
All right. That was a fair assessment, I guess. Okay, so what key development during the two sessions was the expansive institutional reforms, called the party and the state reforms. And two key areas that I see where the reforms were carried out were science and technology and the financial market and the financial securities market. Of course, these two areas have been a priority for the party. And would you like to take us through the developments, the reforms that announced with regard to the Ministry of Science and Technology? And how does one see that?
So I think there has been a lot of focus on scientific and technological growth and advancement, and not just growth, but also expansion of original innovation with the country. And so as per the institutional reform plan, the Ministry of Science and Technology is restructured in a way that it has to play a bigger role in bringing about a new system for technological breakthroughs, optimizing innovation, and also facilitating application of science and tech across various fields. And there has also been an addition of massive macro management functions to the Ministry of Science and Technology, which talk about allocation of resources, comprehensive coordination, so on and so forth. And there has also been the establishment of a central committee on science and technology. And this is supposed to enhance the CVC central committee's ability and its centralized and unified leadership over the work that scientific and technological advancement and breakthroughs are supposed to carry out in the national innovation system. And this central commission is largely supposed to be a decision-making and coordinating body for the CPC central committee. And while the administrative responsibilities of the central committee are to be undertaken by the reorganized Ministry of Science and Technology.
Yeah, so two key takeaways from the restructuring that has happened within the Science and Technology Ministry for me would be that a lot of its functions, earlier functions that it used to cater to, has been rationalized and transferred to Ministry of Agriculture and Rural Affairs, National Development and Reform Commission, Ministry of Ecology and Environment, and National Health Commission. So, I mean, the idea was to relieve Ministry of Science and Technology of the functions that although had an application of technology, but could be better handled by other departments or ministries. And so that most could, the Ministry of Science and Technology could have a strengthened role and be more focused on facilitating breakthrough innovations, high-tech and core technologies, as the explain of the reforms had in its document. And the next thing is that the party is closely involved in this whole issue of core technologies, and as it has, it views that policy of containment and suppression by US and its allies has been a key talking point and has made the party very anxious, and it wants to closely follow the developments, and therefore the establishment of the Central Science and Technology Committee, which will directly oversee the Ministry of Science and Technology. And Ministry of Science and Technology will largely act as an implementing agency of the policies and priorities that Central Science and Technology Committee will develop. So coming on to the other institutional reforms, especially with regard to the Central Finance Committee, how do you see the reforms that have been introduced in the financial sector?
Right. I think so. Apart from the focus on two unswervings, there has also been a massive overhaul of the financial setup of the country. So plans have been announced to establish a new financial regulatory body that will replace China's banking and insurance watchdog, which is China Banking Insurance and Regulatory Commission. And this is part of a wider government overhaul of the State Council's control on finance and economy. And this new body is supposed to bring supervision of the industry under the State Council, and it is under the direct control of the State Council, and it is intended to strengthen, in the same old customary manner, institutional oversight and coordination between different financial markets. And I think this new body is being referred to as the National Bureau of Financial Supervision and Regulation. And the CBIRC is now replaced by this national commission, and it has been brought under the direct control of the State Council. So initially, the three pillars of China's regulatory setup, which are the CBIRC, the People's Bank of China, and the China Securities Regulatory Commission, were all headed by the Financial Stability and Development Committee of the State Council. And then this new body that is replacing the CBIRC will now be under the direct control of the premiership of Li Jiang, and so will be the Securities and Regulatory Commission. In the People's Bank of China, we see that there are major reforms that include the elimination of county and super-regional offices, and the bank's task of also supervising financial companies and their day-to-day regulation will also be taken over by the new National Regulatory and Supervision Committee. And the bank, instead, new provincial offices will be opened for the bank, and all of the county-related work that was being done by the bank before will be transferred to their, to one level up to their city divisions. And if there is a specific need at the grassroots level of governance, it's been told that People's Bank of China will dispatch delegations, or they will dispatch temporary offices to meet those needs. So I think in this sense, there has, some analysts have also argued that there is a focus on dual circulation and uniformity across markets, which these financial regulations have been aimed at, so that both domestic and global circulation of economy are kind of intertwined because of uniformity in how financial and economic institutions work.
Right. So the establishment of this new body called the Central Financial Committee seeks to transfer, or seeks to give the control of China's 58, I'm not sure about the figure, but a large chunk of assets worth to another party's control. And especially that this, and there has been a lot of fear that the party's involvement might give rise to hesitations with regards to the newer investments or release of IPOs. And recently we saw that the Central Security Regulatory Commission that used to review the new IPOs of the IPO being floated by the company. So they were required to be reviewed and the decision was withdrawn. So I think, again, this decision to again transfer this issues related to financial sector under the party's control gives sense of mixed signals and does not boost the confidence, investor confidence in the Chinese market. Anyway, coming on to the next reform that was carried out with regards to the social works department. What do you think about it?
Right. So the establishment of this social works department as part of the party and state institution reform plan more recently has major implications for how the party interacts with private and public sector enterprises. The mandate of the social works department, what stands out from it at least, is that the department is supposed to promote the work of the United Sun and party building across these enterprises, which means that because we're seeing so much regulatory oversight from party committees that are affiliated with private institutions, the social works department will be kind of adding on to their role by making sure that whatever these party committees say, whatever thoughts they have on the daily functioning of these companies is duly implemented, the party ideology is followed, and whatever amendments and accommodations need to be made in, say, the charters of these private companies or in the day-to-day functioning of these private companies are duly accommodated and consolidated. And there has been a lot of kind of analytical focus on the fact that we now know and we've now realized that ideology is kind of figured out. We know that China is an ideological state. Ideology is going to play out in all of day-to-day affairs. And so we can keep that aside, focus on other things. But the case is that we still don't have figured out how much and to what extent the party is willing to go to make sure that the ideology is consolidated across each and every sector, across each and every enterprise and household in the country. And so the establishment and the restructuring of the social works department is an indication on that, on just that, that we don't yet have ideology all figured out. And we are yet to see developments in how party building takes place in the day-to-day functioning of the economy. And this might be a digression, but this just brings me to the Global Civilization Initiative, which Xi Jinping has recently launched. And it's yet another indication of how important ideological factors are, not just in domestic politics, but also in Chinese foreign policy, with Xi Jinping using it as a tool to promote the quote-unquote values China holds dear, which are harmony, inclusivity, multilateralism, so on and so forth. And again, it's an attack on the West in the sense that it wants to tell its partners across the world that the West follows a unilateral model, the West follows a Cold War mentality, it wants to be confrontational, and China is nothing like that. And so I think, the making of the social works department domestically and the Global Civilization Initiative externally just goes to show that with Xi Jinping's third term as president also comes a reminder that the party line is absolute and it's going to play out, and that ideology is going to play out in how the CPC functions domestically and abroad.
Right. Ideology is indeed a key tool of key priority when it comes to Chinese Communist Party. And we have seen multiple instances wherein, and even during a speech that she made at the end of the NPC sessions, wherein he said upholding of centralized and unified leadership of the Central Committee of the Party is of utmost importance with Xi Jinping at its core. And it is key to China pulling itself out of all the troubles and the economic chaos that it is in. And as the party has always pulled people out of several problems, this is the best shot that the people have. There was many more reforms that were discussed, but we have paucity of time. But I think this was a great discussion, Anushka. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst. Or our website, takshashila.org.in.